Okay, so my big seller at San Diego Comic-Con was my pug book and the new one that I have. And this woman at one point, perfectly pleasant woman, comes up and goes, "Hey, I want to get this pug book for a friend back home, but they're very religious. Is this a religious book?"
A religious and pug book.
I wanted to be so sarcastic in that moment. I don't know what would cause me. I didn't say it, but I wanted to say, well, the pug has not yet accepted Jesus Christ as their personal savior yet.
No, it is an unrepentant pug, as most of them are.
Beth and I were joking around in the booth the rest of the weekend, like, well, I mean, the pug is not explicitly a Satanist, but there are some Satanist elements in the book. So,
yeah, there are some themes, some underlying themes of satanic pugism.
Yeah. Well, like, God, as a Wiccan dog owner, like, the jokes just wrote themselves all weekend, you know. But I found that such a strange question. Like, oh, this dog's book looks lovely. Is it a religious book? Like, what?
All dogs are Satan. All dogs are unreligious. Have you seen where they put their noses half the time? These are not religious creatures.
I think that movie might have lied about all dogs going to heaven. I don't know about that.
Purgatory at best.
Yeah, at best. Yeah, they're sitting there with Dante working their way up purgatory. There's no way there. So anyway, I get it, though. We all have that one cousin that's a little too religious, and you're like, all right, we got to, for Greg, we're going to get him this book. But it just seemed like a weird question for pugs, for a pug-related comic strip book. That's so weird.
Is it religious?
Anyway, but San Diego was really good this year. I got a lot to talk about this week, so let's warm it up and we'll get right into it. Yeah,
let's
my friend?
Let's intro it up. I want to hear all about it.
Well then, hi everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, how is San Diego?
Well, for everyone that knows or doesn't know, San Diego Comic-Con is 5 very full days in sunny San Diego along the bay at the convention center there. And it was great this year. There was a lot to like about San Diego Comic-Con this year. Let's start from the outside in. They pedestrianized a lot of the streets around San Diego in the gas lamp and then down right in front of the convention center.
Yeah.
So for folks that have ever been to Comic-Con, you know that there is just a cluster of human beings outside that convention center at key hours.
It can be really daunting.
What's that now?
It can be really daunting out there.
Yeah, and it's also you're assaulted by human smells and elbows and backpacks, you know, as you try to go 10 feet. And it made the show so much more pleasant. And I honestly think it impacted the mood of the show because I heard far less complaints about people standing in lines where people were jerks and this and that because everything was pedestrianized. So they weren't also fighting with buses and trucks and cars and bikes and all this stuff, you know?
Yes.
So really, a hat tip to the San Diego Police Department and the San Diego City Council for letting them pedestrianize a lot of stuff around there. It was really cool.
What kinds of stuff was found out there?
Like in the pedestrianized zone?
Yeah,
well, you and I had talked about this before that I thought it might be dipping a toe towards a European-style convention where you put a lot of big circus tents out there. And it wasn't that. They were because the roads were unpedestrianized like at 9 p.m. to 5 p.m., mm-hmm. So I think with good reason, they didn't have any tents up. There's nothing permanent. But what it became, and this was sort of impromptu, was all the cosplayers would go out there all along the first 3 blocks into Gaslamp, kind of like buskers at a subway station. You would see cosplayers every 20 feet waiting and taking photos with this big group that was around them, you know?
No, that's awesome.
And it was
really
nice.
Because that's what everybody wants to do. Plus, you've got natural light out there.
Yeah, and it was really nice for families. Like, if you've got a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old or whatever, and you're walking through, it's really nice to be able to take all the photos in this nice, open, airy, less crowd. And you're not stopping people trying to get to the next row over. You're out in the middle of a street. It's fine. You know, it's great. It was a really smart move on San Diego's part.
And you get a better photo out of it. You've got natural light. You don't have a convention in the background where people are walking around. You've got, you know, like a regular city background. It's a fantastic idea.
Yeah. And they didn't have food trucks, but they had food carts out. So the kind of thing that a single human could push, you know?
Yeah. Next best thing.
Yeah, so you could get like a New York style hot dog or Mexican street tacos, or you could get ice cream, you know, like small $1, $2, $5 items kind of thing. Anyway, perfect. It was really good. So outside in, San Diego, much, much improved. I got to tell you though, Brad, much to my chagrin, you may have noticed you didn't get a text from the Sci-Fi Cafe this year.
Oh, no. You're not saying.
I don't know what happened, but Sci-Fi did not license that whole cafe that they normally do, the Sci-Fi Channel.
That poor wait staff. How did they make it through the week?
How did they suffer through? Anyway, so that's outside the show. And then you get inside the show. And so you probably heard that Marvel and Disney in general is making less of a presence known at San Diego Comic-Con.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they want to really start pushing D23 because they have Star Wars, they have Marvel, they have all of Disney, they have Pixar, right? Like, so bring it all in-house, which makes sense. I get it.
Yep.
They're going to start making all their announcements. So there was still a Marvel presence. There was still a Star Wars presence. And frankly, they were huge. But there were less fan-driven panels and reveals at the show.
Mm.
And I have to say, it felt like it made a difference in the Comic-Con. Like the only big reveal at Comic-Con was that dumpster fire Aquaman trailer. And yeah. By the way, I'm going to exhibit no opinion on this show about how terrible I think Aquaman is, because I don't want to, if it's already bad, I don't want to make it worse by telling everybody what a shit show it looks like. So
yeah.
Don't go watch the, oh, I'm just kidding. I don't know where I'm going with that.
In the Geiger family, we're going to watch it one way or another, because my wife breaks into a fever every time that actor, what's his name? Jason Momoa?
Momoa.
Every time that guy gets on the screen, she gets a little bit hot under the collar. So I got a feeling we're going to go watch that one, whether I want to or not.
You're like, I'm taking one for the team for my wife's sake on that one.
Yeah.
I get it.
Very much so.
I just feel like Aquaman, I have, you know how many comics I've done making fun of Aquaman over the years about what a stupid character I think he is. And then to make the whole movie about it, and then to cast a guy who obviously chose the voice of a Southern trucker to portray Aquaman. I don't know, like, I just didn't get that choice of Aquaman. Like, hoo-yah, yeah, we're going to go fight some crime. I'm Aquaman.
Yeah, it was a weird vocal. As soon as I heard the vocal on that, I was like, okay, that's going to be different.
That's one of those things where, like, if it's an acting class, the director's like, okay, that was a choice. That was a choice. Let's try it up a little different. Like, I don't know why. I mean, not that I put much thought into it. I don't know why I always thought of Aquaman as having a vaguely British or somewhat regal voice. But to me, Aquaman sounded like, yeah, let's go get him. Come on, let's get some grit. Let's go find them.
Get her done.
Yeah, exactly. Hold on, let me just scratch my crotch here. I'm Aquaman. Yeah, yeah, we got to go fight the Justice League's enemies. Anyway.
Yikes.
So there were markedly less Hall H announcements. Like the big one was Aquaman and maybe Doctor Who. I don't know. And Doctor Who, you know, on the scale of fandom is like, it's solid, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't turn out a lot of huge crowds. Anyway, so I think by virtue of that, there were more people on the floor this year, and it felt less of a media show and more of a comic show a little
Whoa.
Bit. I don't want to overdo it.
Yeah.
I don't want to. It's not like it went totally back to what it was in 1998, but it felt like maybe what it was 10 years ago, you know, which was interesting.
Wow, that's really fascinating.
So I don't know if that's going to be permanent. It might just be the cycle of things that there wasn't a Hobbit movie. There wasn't a Star Wars movie. There wasn't a big Marvel movie being announced, like nothing big that in past would have generated fans.
Actually, the big announcement from Marvel that happened over the weekend was a negative one. And I'm starting to wonder whether that was intentional now as well. Marvel announced that James Gunn was being taken off of the Guardians of the Galaxy third movie because of some tweets that he made a few years ago that were in poor taste.
You say intentional? You mean you think they timed that for Comic-Con?
I don't know if they timed it necessarily, but I'm just thinking it is interesting that the one thing to come out of Marvel that caught my radar was a negative story, and maybe they had it boiling, and they're like, well, we'll just put it out during Comic-Con. We're not throwing out there anything anyway, and we'll save our good stuff for D23.
Oh, I see what you're saying. They kind of buried amongst the other news. Yeah, that's
exactly.
That is conceivable from a PR standpoint. Yeah, I get you. Anyway, the overall mood for the so that's the big picture stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like the outside of the show, really pleasant. The inside of the show, markedly less Hall H announcements this year. And for those that don't know, Hall H is the sort of 5,000 to 7,000 seat area where they would typically bring out, oh, and here's the entire cast of Black Panther, clap, 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 clap. Here's the trailer, that kind of thing, right?
Right.
And justifiably, people wait in line, they get excited. But if you have 5,000 people in a hall and another 5,000 waiting outside the hall to get into that hall, that's 10,000 people that got taken off the floor. And it's noticeable when Hall H lets out.
When I used to do that show with you, we used to be able to tell when the big things were going on down in Hall H because the floor, even at San Diego, would empty out.
Yeah. If you take 150,000 people and then suddenly snap your fingers and 15,000 people are gone, you, honest to God, you notice it. You do notice.
You know one thing. If you've done that, you know that your Infinity Gauntlet is working just fine.
I noticed that you noticed my snap. That's great. That was great.
I'm hitting on all six cylinders over here.
That's right. That's right. Someone had his coffee this morning.
That's right. I did.
So anyway, a lot of people on the show. Everyone was in comparatively good moods. Also, the weather was pleasant. You know, you've been to Comic Cons where it's too hot and people come into the hall and they're just like dying. I just want to sit down.
Right.
So all of the externals that can't be controlled were lovely. It was a really lovely show. And then for me personally, I was the best prepared I had been for a long time. I had two new books. I had a bunch of new pins and new posters and prints and stuff. So it was hands down. Because I just did the numbers yesterday afternoon. I've made all my bank deposits and stuff. It was hands down the best Comic-Con I've ever had, which is great.
Wow. And you know the question I'm going to ask next, because I am a curmudgeon. Did you turn a profit after deducting expenses?
Yes. It turned out, because I did the math on this too, it was 3x cost, so it's great.
Holy cats. You did fantastic.
Yes, you're looking at it. You're listening to a very happy Dave Kellett right now.
So no questions asked. You signed up and got your space for next year.
I haven't yet, but that's because I was
really?
Busy. No, I have. That's just because I was busy. I always email them like a week after the show and be like, hey, guys, I forgot to pick up the old form. Been 20 years. Can I still go tomorrow? So this was my 20th year, by the way, and
wow.
I have to say, the fact that it was my best show ever, and it was also my 20th year, that was a really special thing. It was nice that happened.
Yeah. So going, do they still have what they call a webcomics area?
They do, and it's a little sad now, because there's only about 10 of us in the webcomics area, and there used to be about 30 or 40 of us.
Yeah.
So by what Brad's asking there for people that have never been to Comic-Con, there are certain areas that are like a hanging sign from the ceiling. So there's like a fantasy illustrator area, there's a small press area, there's an artist alley area, and there's a webcomics area.
Yeah.
And webcomics, when we first petitioned Comic-Con, I don't know, 10 years ago, Brad, to get the webcomics area designated, there was probably 30 or 40 webcomic artists going. You know, it was everybody from Penny Arcade to Jeff Jacks to Rich Stevens to Scott Kurtz. To Brad Scott, Chris and I, to Patico, to Keenspot, right? Like Brad, that's some of the big names that were there. And then everybody stopped going.
Phil Folio was always down there in a little anchor position.
Yep. And Phil is still there. Dumbrella is still there. Topatico is still there. Cyanide and Happiness is there. Looking for Group is there. And I'm there. And a couple other names that folks would remember. So it's still like, it's not like it's nothing, but it's not what it was 10 years ago. And for good reason, for the same reason that I don't go to New York Comic Con, it's really expensive to come from the East Coast, fly out, get 5 nights, sometimes 6 nights at San Diego Comic Con hotels.
Yeah.
And then also pay for a $2,000 booth. Like that, those costs add up real quick, which is why I don't do New York. So I get it why people stop coming. So what we're left with is mostly the West Coast cartoonists who can drive to Comic-Con and or have a friend to stay with at Comic-Con. Don't you think? That's kind of who's left.
That's when you're describing it, that's very much who it sounds like. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, Yeah, so webcomics rows have been diminished, but it's so, still fighting. Although
here's
a
question. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I heard from two people this weekend that this might be their last year. So we'll see if that's going to grow smaller yet. Although there were two cartoonists that came down from Canada this year who were very excited. Sam Logan of Sam and Fuzzy did great, by the way, at Comic-Con. And he's like, oh, boy, I'm definitely coming back next year. So yeah. We'll see what happens.
So do you think Small Press or Artist Alley ballooned in size this year? In other words, if webcomics is shrinking, is there another group that's enlarging at this particular show?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I have a couple questions for you about Artist Alley at San Diego Comic-Con. So first of all, San Diego, to their credit, still has an Artist Alley, and it's substantial. It takes up, I don't want to overdo it. Let's say it takes up like a 40th of the show floor, right?
Yeah.
There's probably 100 tables of Artist Alley. And the problem, though, is that it's at the very far end of the convention center from all the exhibitor artists. So all their publishing houses, all the comic book shops. It's like on the other end of video games and products.
It's over in no person's land.
Yeah, it's like in the ass end of the Comic-Con. So I really feel bad about the Artist Alley location. And then I also feel bad because right in the middle of Artist Alley, you know how sometimes you get into an old, not a DC-10, but like an older plane. And sometimes they used to run the row not right down the middle of the plane. So you would have four seats on one side and one seat on the other, or two seats.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, you've ever gotten on one of those weird planes and you're like, why didn't they run the row right down the middle? This is the weirdest thing. That's what they did with Artist Alley. So you would have seven artists in a row and then a big 20 to 25 foot gap row in the middle where people could walk up and down, and then two more artists on the other side. And you're like, well, those poor artists that no one's ever going to walk over there.
Yeah.
I just felt bad for them, basically. It was a really weird logistical decision on San Diego's part. I don't know.
There's got to be a reason, but I couldn't imagine what it would be, because it seems like it would be very, very simple to just kind of make it go down the middle and equal things up.
Yeah, my brother-in-law and I were walking that area, and I said, psychologically, do you feel this? We are not going to turn down those rows. And he goes, yeah, that's interesting. I go, those people really got shafted. So it was just interesting. Anyway, but here's my question to you, because you might know this better than I do. So we all know either web cartoonists or artists that could either qualify for Artist Alley or Small Press, which is another area of Comic-Con. But help me out here. What is the difference between Small Press and Artist Alley? Like, why differentiate?
Well, I've got a feeling. See, here's the deal. Back in the day, before they had a webcomics area, we were all considering just going and taking over the Small Press area. I remember that being a topic of discussion among a lot of web cartoonists, that we would just go over there and put up our, you know, plant our flags and kind of, because we were technically Small Press. As far as the difference goes, I don't honestly know, but I'm going to give you my guess based on the little bit I know about how that show works. And that is, as you know, San Diego, it's one of those deals that once you get in, you got to keep re-upping your booth for next year, or else you lose your place in line and somebody else comes in and takes it. In other words, most of the people you see at San Diego were there last year, and the only reason that they got that booth was that they were there the year before, and the year before that, and the year before that. And supposedly you can't bequeath a booth to anyone else, but there's that kind of you keep getting grandfathered in. As a result, it's really difficult to get in to San Diego and prove that you've invested in the show in the past. One of the places that you can do that is Artist Alley.
Right.
And so I've got a feeling the answer to your question is, what's the difference? It's what you could get. In other words, chances are you can't immediately get a place on the floor, and that would include Small Press, but you might be able to get Artist Alley. So you go in, you buy a place on Artist Alley, and then you're in line for the next time when a hole opens up. And just like we did way back in the day, you wait for a hole to open and you take your shot, and boom, all of a sudden you've got it. And now your biggest worry is you've got to hold on to it for next year and the year after that, because now you're running the treadmill. But I've got a feeling that Artist Alley is probably the place, and I'm sure our listeners will correct me if I'm wrong, but my guess is that's the place where you get your nose in the tent, and then you can you can move on from there.
Yeah, no, so I completely concur with you from a logistical standpoint in terms of applying to Comic-Con, but I guess what I was asking you was, from a planning standpoint, from Comic-Con's planning standpoint, why does that exist? What differentiates an Artist Alley attendee from a small press attendee? You're saying that, small press is the grandfathered area.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, exactly. Small press is part of the grandfathered area. And as far as like thematically, there's no difference whatsoever. You could easily be, if you're in small press, you could be in one or the other. If you're an artist for DC or a writer for Marvel, then you're not as likely to go into small press. You're going to be more likely to go into Artist Alley or to be sitting at your publisher's table. But as far as like thematically, nah, there's no real difference there that I can tell.
Yeah. Cause for me, I could see myself being an Artist Alley. I could see myself being in small press. I could see myself being an exhibitor. Like I could see all
exactly.
You could argue one or the other for all those, you know? So, all right. I was just sort of curious what your thought was on that. Anyway, so I was going to tell you the big takeaway that I had from this show. And it's something that you and I have talked about in the past, but this one really cemented it, which is, last year, boy, I thought I was going to do gangbusters at San Diego Comic-Con. And I'll tell you why. And it was totally ego-driven and totally naive to how Comic-Cons work. Uh-huh. I had just published my Drive hardcover book, right? It was 7 years in the making or whatever it was. It was 300 pages and it had had a $104,000 Kickstarter. And I was like, this is going to do great at Comic-Con. I'm going to do gangbusters. I'm going to sell so many of these. I'm bringing 15 boxes of these really heavy books, right?
Yeah, and those Drive books are big.
Yeah, and I'm telling you all this because I had a great year this year, but I want to tell you about the not as great year last year because of bad assumptions and bad planning. So I brought no joke, like 15 boxes of these things, thinking I'm going to sell through the world. I'm going to buy my solid gold car with these books. Anyway, I then proceeded to sell, I don't remember the exact numbers, but let's just say I sold like 15 copies of those, which at $50 a pop is great, but... Right. I had a lot of books to bring home last year, like pretty much exactly what I brought, I had to bring back with me last year.
And there's nothing worse than packing up from a convention and carrying all of those boxes out that you didn't sell. You know?
Oh, the humility level skyrockets.
I've been there.
And then
it is the working cartoonist's walk of shame. It's Sunday night when you're walking and you've got a full dolly or a full hand cart that you are pushing out to your car. That is the cartoonist's walk of shame.
It's the cartoonist equivalent of, remember in eighth grade when you would have a dance and all the boys would be lined up on one side of the gym and all the girls would be lined up on the
other. Oh, I remember that well.
And whoever was brave enough to walk to the other side of the gym and ask somebody if they wanted to dance, and then they would say no, and then you'd have to walk all the way back across the gym.
Make that long walk back.
That's the emotional state of a cartoonist that has to bring back an awful lot of books after Comic-Con.
Yes.
It's just the long, dark tea time of the soul. Anyway, last year I was like, these books, oh, that Kickstarter did so great. I'm going to sell so many of these. And here's the dirty truth about Comic-Con is that, A, it's really hard to entice a stranger into a long-form story that they've never heard of before.
Yes. Yeah,
and
that's
then
true.
It's even harder to entice a stranger into a long-form story they've never heard of before that's in a $50 hardcover collection.
Like, You're right.
No one, I mean, looking back on it, I don't know why I ever thought I was going to sell any of those at Comic-Con. Like, what a dummy. The price point, it's a big ask. It's a big ask from a stranger, you know?
Right. Whereas short form, do you think that's easier as a convention buy?
So I do. I think it's easier. Yeah. I think it's really hard to sell long form at a Comic-Con. And I'm saying this as a cartoonist that online via Patreon and Kickstarter, I make way more via Drive, right? So it's not like I'm negating the value of long form storytelling in comics. It's by virtue of my own career, it's way better for me. But I think at Comic-Con, it's not an easy sell. I think it's quite hard, frankly, to sell long form to someone who's never heard of it.
So now let's workshop this a bit. There's got to be a way. There's got to be a way to sell long format conventions. What would you do differently than bringing 15 boxes of that huge book to a convention? That, you know, well, what I mean? What would you do different than trying to sell those heavy hardcovers?
Well, I'll tell you what I did do last year because I had extras of them. I brought 100, 150 copies of my previous floppy versions of Drive that were like 90-page collections, right?
Yeah.
And what I did was, because those were essentially burner copies now, I sold them all just cheap, $5. Like, well, if you're not willing to jump in, try the $5 version, and you get 90 pages, and that's a pretty good value by most Marvel DC standards. So try it out. And I had a lot of people. I sold out of those last year, but no one was willing to try the $50. You know, well, 15 people were, but... But that, I think, is the solution, is that you go either big flyer that introduces people, and that's the best you can hope for because you're not going to get the sale, or smaller, floppier version. What would be your thoughts? What would you try to do?
I think you're heading in exactly the right direction, and I almost wonder whether it wouldn't be... I would expand on those two things you said, and I wonder how this would work. Number one, with the flyer... I would also include like a discount code where they can buy it online for a discount to entice them to take that extra step, because you know you're never going to, most of the flyers that they take home are getting thrown away immediately and never get looked at again. If you have some kind of financial enticement in it for them, then they can go back and do that. And I almost wonder whether it wouldn't be, I don't know. I you'd have to do a cost benefit analysis, but even taking that floppy version one step further down and have almost like a pamphlet or a like a comic book printed on cheaper paper and stapled that is just an introduction to the story, and the last page being purchasing information either at the convention or online. I wonder if that would be worth the cost that it would take to do it.
Yeah, so like I haven't done SPX in years, but what do they call those little stapled things that they sell?
Ash cans.
Ash cans,
yeah.
You do like an ash can version, is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And hand that out as a staple, as they're standing, you know, something as they're standing there as a giveaway, and see what the reaction
is. Well, what's the cost per unit on an ash can, do you know, offhand?
Well, it depends on how you do it, but like most of those ash cans are just done at the copier place. They're Xerox. They're not color. They're black and white. They're stapled. So the per cost is probably just got to be 10 or 20 cents, don't you figure?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I guess I was thinking of a bigger ash can.
If you're doing Xeroxes, let's call it an 8-page
or a 12-page. Yes. So yeah, maybe 60, 80 cents. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Right now there's some indie cartoonist out there that's tearing their hair out listening to
us.
They're 95 cents. They're 95 cents.
Well, let's agree that it's under a dollar.
Okay. Yeah. So if you just took that cost, I mean, maybe what you do is you sell them for a buck. If they cost you a buck, you sell them for a buck. That's very doable at Comic-Con. And you just assume that a percentage of those sales will lead to bigger sales, or as a test case anyway. I have no idea if they would lead to bigger sales. But I had a lot of people, though, and self-identifiably nerds at Comic-Con. They're either wearing a Star Wars shirt or a Star Trek shirt or, you know, a NASA shirt or something. And they would stop and they would read like 40 pages of Drive at the booth off to the corner. And I would just let them. But my thought was, A, it's fine. A percentage of these people are going to buy it. And they did at the show. But more to the point, if you've stopped and read 40 pages, when you get home, you're going to keep reading that. You're going to go find it. And
one would hope.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, God knows. Maybe there's people that are just like, Comic-Con is my library. Wee! You know, maybe. But I feel like a percentage of those people will. There'll be some action that's beneficial to me that'll follow up on the 40 pages that they read. Either they'll go become a reader online or they will come back and buy the book, you know?
Yep. And that's where having at least, if not an ash can, definitely a flyer handy so that you can make sure that you send that person off with something that they've got a chance to breadcrumb it back to you on the web, whether it's Instagram or your website or wherever. You've got to, that your flyer is your best friend. That's one thing you don't want to skimp on at a big show is making sure you got lots of flyers.
I continue to use 8.5 by 11 flyers that are double side printed. And one side is nerdier jokes and one side is more middle of the road. Like, oh, you're a librarian. So depending on who I see walking by the booth, I will literally flip my wrist and it'll be like, here's the nerd side. Here's the librarian side. Or, you know, here's the mom with three kids side. I still find the flyer to be, I know a lot of people don't like doing flyers. I'm pretty outgoing and gregarious at a Comic-Con, so I have no problem handing a bunch of strangers flyers. My critique of my current flyer design is I need to put a map back to my booth, and I need to put the two or three major items that they saw at the booth on the flyer so that they can remember, where was that booth that had the such and such book, and where was that booth? You know, I need to do a better job of that on my flyer.
I'm a big fan of having a map back to your booth at a show. And I got that way by being on foot at a couple of shows and realizing how quickly I'd lose track of where that thing was that I liked, right? I'd see something, and this happened to me in San Diego all the time. I'd see something and I'd be like, oh, that's a great gift to bring home for my son. And I would be like, I got to make sure I come back here before the end of the show. And then I would spend the rest of the weekend trying to remember where the hell I saw that thing at. And so I became very, very quickly a big fan of putting a map of your booth placement on a flyer and also putting it up online that you see more and more people doing so that your fans can find you, that people that just discovered you can find it on the flyer. That's a big, big plus.
Yeah, so I'll give an example. I might as well give a shout out because I'd never heard of them before, but I like the artwork. I walked by in the morning with my coffee, a booth called The Adventures of 19XX, and they have a really cool early to mid-century design style in their comics that's almost propagandistic. You know, it's like, you know, put the elbow grease into it. We can beat Hitler. That kind of a feel, you know? Anyway, I just noted it as like, oh, wow, that's a really cool design. I want to come back and look at that. And honest to God, Brad, I've done Comic-Con for 20 years. I couldn't find the booth again once I lost them. I was wandering around like an old chicken going, where's the peckings? I don't know where to go. The ability to be able to give readers a quick and easy way back to your booth is key if you're going to do a flyer. So having passed out the last of my 5,000 flyers this weekend, I'm going to do an entirely new design for this next show. So that's a bit of a learning one. But anyway, my big takeaway from Comic-Con, and you and I have talked about this for the last couple of years, is that for the average person coming to Comic-Con, you have to realize the show is no longer about comics. It hasn't been for a while. It's a part of the show. But to me, what Comic-Con is, if you're going to do it and you've never done it before, is Comic-Con is about the experience for most people.
Yes.
And when you internalize that it's about the experience, it's not necessarily about your book, that can actually help you sell your book to people who are there for the experience. And here's what I mean by that. Okay, so I will give you an example. So I spent X amount of dollars buying my booth, getting all the promotional materials for my booth, all the book stands, all the tablecloths, all the stuff that you need for a Comic-Con, right? That was my budget. But I spent that hoping to make that back plus a profit, right? So that was my hope for Comic-Con. In the meantime, 30 booths over, Fox had a booth that they probably spent $500,000 on for Deadpool that served no purpose. It served no purpose in terms of helping the overall profit of Deadpool other than to show an animatronic Deadpool dancing with the singing cast of a Chuck E. Cheese pizza place called Showtime Pizza that used to exist.
I remember Showtime.
Yeah, you remember Showtime Pizza? By the way, excellent documentary on what happened to Showtime. Look for it on Netflix or Hulu. I don't know where it is.
Really? But,
Brad, it's amazing. You've got to watch this documentary.
I love those documentaries. God, this one is sucked right into them.
Having made a documentary myself, I got to tell you, this is a low-budget documentary that really brings it home. They did a great job.
I can't wait.
So definitely look for that one. Anyway, Fox built a whole stage that's just an animatronic Deadpool singing, working 9 to 5 with the Showtime pizza players. And the gorilla and the bear, they're all dressed up in X-Men outfits. It's the funniest thing, right? It's
oh my God.
It builds the brand of Deadpool, no doubt at all. But what I'm getting at is they are building an experience, Fox is, so that you remember Deadpool and so that you and I do exactly what we're doing right now, which is to talk about Deadpool, right?
Right.
Like that booth did what it was supposed to do, but the goal was to create an experience that you talk about, not to sell you an item, not to make a profit on that booth.
Right.
And this is what I'm getting at in terms of Comic-Con is once you realize that most of the booths at Comic-Con are there to provide you with an experience as a fan or as a reader so that you don't you go back and either buy or get the DVD or go stream Star Wars or buy a video game or whatever somewhere else.
Yeah.
That's a very different thing than a cartoonist going to a show and saying, buy my book, buy my book, buy my book. You know, that's a very different purpose for that booth.
And so, it's jarring for somebody who, you know, again, if you, I'm really kind of getting into what you're saying, and that is the person walking out there is there for the experience, and all of a sudden you're jarring them into another reality when you're trying to turn it into a shopping trip.
Yes, that's exactly it. So
yeah.
Here comes a family of four walking by your booth. They've just got to sit for free and watch a $500,000 Deadpool exhibit sing to them. Then they walked past the Dark Horse booth and got a free bag handed to them with three Dark Horse comics inside of it.
Yep.
Then they walked by ABC and got a free poster tube with a free poster inside of it. And then they get to Dave Kellett and I'm going, hey, how are you? Have you tried Drive?
Yeah, exactly.
Would you like to buy Drive?
What the hell? What are you going to give me? And,
yeah,
and how many times did we have people come up to our tables and say, and just pick up a book and walk away? And it's like, oh, I thought you were giving these away. And of course, we looked at them like they've got snakes coming out of their nose. But it's actually not only forgivable, it's actually us who is maybe out of step with what the expectations are, right?
Right. We are the odd men out increasingly at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
Out of the 100 or so rows or whatever it is, there's maybe 15, 20 rows that are trying to sell you comics. And the other ones are all trying to sell you an experience so that you go and buy the or partake of that product somewhere else, you know?
So now, wait a minute, Dave, how are you telling me that you made three times your expenditure? You didn't do that. How do you do that? You didn't do that all through experiences, did you?
Yes, I offer everybody a warm and reassuring hug for $5.
Well, and Brad, that's having been on the receiving end of that, that's worth it.
I was going to say, you've been on the receiving end of more than a few lingering Dave Kellett hugs. And I got to tell you, that's worth the $5.
I just, at one point, just handed you my credit card.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Don't ask where I ran it. That's just... but you know, you get what you pay for in terms of hugs, and it's an experience. It's I don't want to say IMAX, but it's an experience.
Yeah, you maxed it right out, as I remember. But anyway,
a short trip to Mexico, and I was right back.
I didn't mean to sound sarcastic. I'm trying to get my head around this. How do I survive in that that environment? Of everybody else is offering experiences as an artist, what kind of experience can I possibly offer?
Okay, so here are my three takeaways, four takeaways that you can do at Comic-Con, right? For working within an environment that is, for most people, an experience, not a purchasing moment.
Yeah.
So, point number one, your fans will be there, and the fans that will be there will be your super fans. So you want to sell to them with exclusives and with sketches and with all that sort of stuff. And frankly, with friendship, you're genuinely thankful that they're there. I am anyway. And it's fun to catch up with them. And they are incredibly supportive. And they will buy my original art because I'm going to sign it in person. They'll buy a book because I'll sketch in it in person. They'll buy exclusives because they know from my website that they exist only at the show and not at the site. So that's number one. That for me is a really big core audience. And frankly, those are the people that I come to serve. That's the audience that I want to nurture, right? There, in many respects, some of those are relationships that fans I've been talking to and selling to and sketching for 10 years. And so it's a lovely thing to nurture. So that's the core, right? For me anyway.
Yeah.
Then the second one are people who, even though they didn't come to buy a comic book, they're like, hey, this looks interesting. What is this? What's Anatomy of Animals? And then I explain to them, oh, it's a spoof on biology books, but we make fun of different animals as though they're personalities. And they start reading it and they start laughing and they show it to their boyfriend or their wife or whatever it is. And then they buy it, right? So that's number two. They didn't know they were coming for a book, but they're going to buy a book. And oh, by the way, there's a free sketch with it. Oh, great. How nice. Oh, and here's a flyer and you can check out my comics when you get home. Oh, nice. Lovely. Nice to meet you. Enjoy the show. Bitty bada boom. You're done, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So those are the two core audiences for whom I'm selling. And then the third one is the experience. And this one, I will give credit where credit is due. Jake Parker and Sam Logan of Sam and Fuzzy do this amazingly, which is part of why you would go to Comic-Con to get an experience is that there might be artists there. So, look at, here's some artists where you could pay them to create something for you while you watch. Oh, that's interesting. Right. Hey, kids, come over here. Mommy's going to pay $40 and have Mr. Sam Logan draw our dog. This is fun. Or, oh, hey, guys, come over here. Look at here's Mr. Jake Parker, and he's going to draw Spider-Man as a robot for us. And look at that. Isn't that fun? And that's an experience. You know, you can make a request of an artist, pass them some money, and watch while they create what you've asked for. That is an absolute Comic-Con experience for some families. And Jake and Sam, to their credit, and me to a smaller extent, make that part of our routine. And it's fun because you're basically a dancing monkey, but it's fun to be a dancing monkey for a cartoonist that's mostly in their own studio by themselves. And so that's the third one. And then the fourth one is I forgot. Brad, I was talking 1 through 3 and I forgot what the fourth one was.
I'm over here sitting on tenterhooks trying to figure out what number 4 could be.
Oh, well, I guess number 4, maybe this was it. I don't remember if this was it. The fourth one I think is sell to people for down the road. And what I mean by that is the flyers, the people that read 40 pages of Drive, the agents that you talk to, the potential jobs for down the road, that's also what makes Comic-Con worth it. So you're building leads for down the road. That's another big one that I do at Comic-Con.
You're planting seeds.
That's a better way to say it. Yes, good.
Yeah. I like this idea of selling a sketch as an experience. I really like what you're saying there.
Well, you know me that I had always made a big selling point that like any book that you buy from me at Comic-Con or frankly, any book that you bring to Comic-Con that you've already bought, I will put a sketch in it. Because for me, that was part of cementing the relationship of like you and I have met. Here's a fun memento of the moment that you can show to friends. And frankly, we've cemented our relationship and great. How lovely. Right. But Sam Logan and Jake Parker and Laura D'Souza and others take it to the next level where they say, not only do we meet and I can give you a quick sketch, but if you'd like a really good illustrated creation that I take some time on and craft, then that'll be $40. That'll be $200. That'll be $300, whatever level you agree on for the, you know, complexity of the sketch. And a lot of people really like that. That's for comic super fans. They come to Comic-Con and they go around and look for Neil Adams or look for, think of anybody you can think of cartoonist wise. And they look for them and buy their sketches or commission sketches. So,
I know Jake does this, that kind of builds off of that in terms of having the more elaborate illustration. Cause I saw him, talking about it on social media. He takes pre-show commissions so that if people say, I want you to draw this, that, and the next, he can do it at his studio on the weeks coming up to the convention in good conditions and then present that to the person in person at the show, right?
Right. Well, and
which
that's
I think is a great idea.
That's what Beth and I did for this show was I
did
said
you, really?
You can either buy a $150, $250 line art illustration from me, and I will get it done early. Or you could buy a $250 to $300 watercolored line art commission from me, and I would do that. Beth and I would do that early, and we would bring them to the show. And so what was really fun is you can spend some time on it in down moments and get it done, and then you still have the personal experience of picking it up from the artist at the show. And for me, God, it was lovely to see families' reactions. There was one family, the Ramirez family, I'm going to remember them. I wish I had videotaped it because that moment as a marketing moment was amazing. Their reaction was adorable and so fun and so genuine. And it was such a real bonding moment between artist and audience. And they were happy and I was happy. And they loved their commission and it was great. I wish I would have videotaped it. But anyway, The idea that you can get it done from home or at night after Comic-Con is over and bring it in the next day, that's a great way to work it. So there's the Sam Logan model, which is I will do it for you for $40 right in front of you. Or there's the Jake Parker model, which is I'll do it for hundreds and I'll take it home and work on it. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great idea. And if and it's also a good way to kind of build up buzz before the show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great. So that commissions alone, the pre-show commissions alone added $1,000 to my Comic-Con. So I can't recommend that.
Wow.
That was great. That was well worth doing.
And then did I see on some of the stuff you were posting that Beth was coloring them as well?
Yeah, and I make it very clear that that you're getting, frankly, you're getting a far better colorist by having Beth do it than I'm doing it.
Yeah.
So that's how we did that one. Yeah, it was good. She does the for those.
Now,
that
what did she use to color it?
What's that?
What did she use? Color pencil.
We
really.
I normally would draw on Bristol, but in this case,
yeah.
We found through some light experimentation in the last few months that water Bristol not great for watercolors. So yeah. We got some. I don't know if it was cold press or hard press watercolor paper, and we've been doing some of the commissions on that, and it looks great. It looks amazing.
That's nice.
But what else? Oh, there's so much to talk about. Okay, so my big takeaway for you and me is I want there to be a Comic Lab panel at San Diego Comic-Con in like 2 or 3 years. I want to grow this show, and I want to have fun and have you at the Comic-Con, Brad. That's my goal.
A Comic Lab panel at San Diego would actually get me on a plane.
Would it? Oh, great.
That I think I'd come out for.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, I just thought that would be a fun one to do at that show.
Yeah, that's something I definitely miss is the panels that we used to do together. That was some of the most fun because you can go. It's the same as doing a podcast, but you can hear people reacting to what you're saying. And and those were some of my best loved moments. Was doing panels with you guys.
Yeah, it was really really fun. We could record a live Comic Lab from the and take live questions. That would be super fun.
Oh, yeah.
So that's my goal. And also, Brad, because my Swiss cheese memory, I just remember what point number 4 was from earlier.
Not that one you made up on the spot. You got a number. You got another number 4?
Well, now I got a number 5, I guess. Okay. Look at me.
Well, good. I'll take a number 5.
I am a font of information, Brad. That's what I am. Yes. You know what it is? There's just so many thoughts coming out of this Comic-Con that I want to talk to you about that they're coming fast and furious, and so I forgot one.
I can tell. I can tell.
So the other thing, the fifth point now about selling to the experience of Comic-Con is you have to recognize as an artist, and this is not true for like Des Moines Regional Dragon Con 2018. Like that, this is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the big shows like New York Comic Con, San Diego Comic Con, maybe Emerald City Comic Con, maybe even a TCAF or something like that. What you have to realize is there's a percentage of people that go there and love the experience and it's super fun, but the guilt creeps in about their girlfriend that couldn't come or the one son that couldn't make it or the husband that had to work that weekend and so couldn't come. And so there's a lot of purchases at a big show that are guilt purchases. And what I mean by that is like, oh, Susan couldn't come because she had that extra shift this weekend at the hospital. So let's get her a book. Oh, Susan loves animals. Let's get her this book. Or, oh, Susan, she'd love a sketch of her, you know, of her, I don't know, whatever, fish. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
So many purchases at Comic-Con are guilt purchases for the person that couldn't go to Comic-Con. And you as a cartoonist can play to that if you think about ways to do whatever it is in your genre or whatever it is in your body of work that can be used to sell to someone that's not there. You can play to that. So that was my fifth point, Brad.
That's where your pug books particularly are so powerful because I've seen people come up time and time again when I used to exhibit with you, and they weren't necessarily Sheldon fans, they weren't necessarily Drive fans, but they'd see that pug on the cover and they'd be drawn to it like a magnet. And the neat thing about that is you can buy that book for anyone who's got a pet or anyone who happens to have a dog, especially if they've got a pug. But it's the perfect gift book. And I could see if you are going to do a convention, making sure that you've got your something on your table that's not necessarily specific to you or your niche or your title, but something that can be used as a gift to somebody that's got a broad appeal, and you're going to do real well. And then what happened, at time and time and year after year after year, those people that had no idea who you were came up and bought a pug book as a gift, came back because lo and behold, they became Sheldon readers over the past year because that's how they gained entry into your world. And now they're here for the rest of the damn books.
That, you know what? That very thing happened this year on Thursday, where someone came up, and the husband and wife, they said, we bought your the last of your pug books last year, and we loved it, and we'd like to get another one of your books. And then they looked at all the books that I had, and they bought one of each. And Brad, it was like a $280 purchase just coming up from that.
I love when that happens. When somebody comes up and buys the entire run of Evil Inc., it's the best feeling in the world. You just want to reach out and hug them.
Yeah, and that's why I don't even charge for the hug at that point. I'm just...
no, you're giving that one away for free.
Yeah, I give the milk away for free. To heck with buying the cow.
Oh, yeah, I love that feeling.
Oh, but geez, Brad, I have so much I want to talk to you about, though, about the show. Sorry, I'm now like an excited little kid.
Yeah.
Oh, Brad, and there was ice cream, and there's a roller coaster. Oh, and I got to meet Mickey Mouse. Oh, man. The one thing that I wanted to talk to you about is you and I in the past have talked about Instagram as a growing platform for comics, right?
Yeah.
And I grew Instagram as fast as I could to whatever level it was, 10,000, whatever level lets you link away from Instagram.
Yeah.
And everybody listening can immediately know the value in being able to link away from a platform to say, hey, did you like this? Go buy it. That kind of thing. Right.
Right.
So I very quickly built up to Instagram to whatever level that was, and then kind of let it lie fallow and have just been posting comics on Instagram. I do like the format very, very much on Instagram. Mm-hmm. I like the panel by panel sliding, all sorts of stuff. I had, because not everybody's going to say it, I had possibly a dozen to two dozen people come up and buy something saying, oh, I just started reading you on Instagram. And to me, that was such a big light bulb moment of, oh, it's working.
Yeah.
Because I really had never had, aside from being able to link away from something, I really had never had big moments of like, oh, yeah, the Instagram stuff was worth putting the time in. Whereas right here, right in front of me, there was probably $200 to $500 worth of sales from Instagram. And so I just want to say, for whatever that's worth, in a non-scientific way, I did have a lot of noticeable sales from Instagram at Comic-Con. So for those of you that are on the fence about it, I think it's probably worthwhile to start posting on Instagram.
So did you do any outreach on Instagram about the show as the show was coming up?
I did. For the first time that I had ever done it on Instagram, I had my face on there saying like, hey, as a post, like, hey, here I go. I'm going to be at Comic-Con. And then I had a couple specialized posts saying, hey, not only will I be at Comic-Con, but here's where my booth is. Here's where all my exclusives are. Like over six or seven tiles, that kind of thing. And then over the last two comics that ran, I don't know, Wednesday or Friday of Comic-Con, it would be panel one, panel two, panel three, advertising for Comic-Con. You get the idea.
By the way, I enjoyed your Galactus World Eater comic.
Oh, the one I like that one. My favorite is every once in a while you get a moron that will explain the joke to you. And I love it when people are like, so the joke for people at home was Galactus World Eater. That was panel one. Panel two was he's checking a weight loss app. And panel three just has him in front of a tiny, sad little planet. And it says Forest Moon. Right. That's the joke. It works better visually. But I loved that the people would come up to me on either on Instagram or in person and go, I get it. Forest Moon is like a salad. Brad, Forest Moon is like a salad. I'd be like, you figured it out.
It's got a lot of green.
Yep. Good job, champ. Thank you, Sherlock, for explaining my joke to me. I want to say I see why the London police keep you on retainer, Sherlock. You're doing a great job over there. Saving Instagram one comment at a time. Good job.
It's nice that people are willing to come up and explain your humor to you.
But what is that impulse? That's a weird impulse to explain a joke to someone, especially the person that made it.
Listen, we having done conventions for a long time, we know that this thing attracts an awful lot of people for whom social interaction maybe isn't the strong suit.
Not what they're known for. Oh, Greg, he's real good at the socializing, that Greg. Oh, he's going to Comic-Con. Oh, how interesting.
Not exactly the wheelhouse, exactly.
Right. Well, let me ask you a question about that relatedly.
Yeah.
So you have a wonderful phrase of booth barnacles that you've used for 15, 20 years.
Yes.
I don't know if that's not – is that a phrase you came up with, or is that just one that I got from you?
It is the one when I finally pass on – there's not going to be a lot to say about me, except you will be able to say that I coined that term that everybody uses now, booth barnacle. It goes all the way back to a Greystone Inn comic that I made. I think the first or second year that I did San Diego, I did a bunch of strips about San Diego, and I coined that term. But yeah, I have been able to find no uses of that term before that. So be prepared to put that on my obit that I coined that term.
Well, first of all, a doff of the cap to you, sir, from Los Angeles, because I think the phrase booth barnacles is amazing. Second of all, for our younger listeners or people who have not yet gone to a Comic-Con, can you explain to them what the concept of a booth barnacle is?
Oh, that's real easy. A booth barnacle is somebody that comes up to your table and overstays their welcome. And that's the key point is that person has overstayed and that amount of time, it might be different for different situations and different people. But they are unable to realize that, their time is up and move on. And as a result, they just kind of plant themselves on, at the front of your booth. In some cases, making it hard for you to interact with other people who might be coming up, or in some cases, just making it impossible for you to take a few moments and decompress and enjoy the lulls that happen as they happen and kind of regroup your mental footing. But some of the key parts of this is, number one, overstaying your welcome, and number two, just not being able to realize that you've long since gone into a one-sided conversation and the person is not responding an awful lot. Am I missing any key elements there?
No, you're not. To me, the most extreme version of a booth barnacle is talk. And then you're like, well, thanks so much for coming, right? You give the universal audio cue of, okay, this has been nice. Let's move it along.
Right.
And then they don't move, or this is the worst. They go absolutely silent and continue to stand staring at you smilingly with like this awkward, you're like, am I expected to lead the conversation now that I've tried to exit? What's happening?
Yeah. And they don't pick up the social cue. And we had a whole routine that we used to do to kind of talk about this. But you start with, well, thanks for coming out. It was great to see you. And then they stay. And then you shake their hand. Remember that? That's the next step. That's an additional social cue. It's like a handshake usually happens at the beginning and at the end of an interaction.
Yeah.
So now you shake their hand. Hey, thanks again for coming on. I know I can't keep you. There's another little hint. I know I can't keep you here. There's lots of show for you to go out and see. I don't want to hold you up. And then they stay. And then you do the patented, I don't know which one of us.
It was you. It was absolutely you, because I'm so thankful to you for inventing it.
But then what you do is you give them one more cue, one more verbal cue. Thanks so much for coming out. You shake their hand and then you pat them with your opposite hand. You pat them on the shoulder. And with the third pat, you just give a little push. And I've actually had, because once you get the inertia going, once they've got it, you get them to kind of stumble and move their weight. Now they've got inertia and they just float away.
It's funny because It's not like you're trying to pull a true asshole move like Trump trying to handshake a world leader.
Right.
You're just giving like 2 to 4 pounds of pressure on their shoulder, just enough to remind them that like, oh, moving is a possible choice at this point.
Yes.
You know,
just it's got to be gentle, like a butterfly kiss on their shoulder, because you don't want to actually push, but there's no other better verb for it. But you just give them a little gentle persuasion.
Although I do remember one Comic-Con being next to you, and there was someone that was not getting the hint. So you went back in again, and you not only did the shoulder push, but you did maybe 5 pounds of pressure pulling with the hand that was shaking. So their leg absolutely turned by Brad applying like 10, 15 pounds of pressure. He did a push-pull, and it was the most amazing move I've ever seen, because this guy had been here for like 45 minutes, and you have to understand at a Comic-Con, that's interminable. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
When you're longer than most episodes of television, it's time to go, you know?
Yeah. Like, so what do you think? Okay, now let's try to quantify this. What do you think is an acceptable amount of time for somebody to be in front of your table? I think if it goes over 20 minutes, then you've overstayed.
20 minutes?
Yeah. Well, 20 minutes.
God bless you, Brad Geiger, for giving 20 minutes to your fellow man and women, but that's ridiculous. No.
What do you think the general time frame for a visit should be?
God, Brad, 20 minutes. Sorry, I'm still on that. No. Okay, if it's sketching, it goes as long as the sketch. So
right,
you close
right.
the book, you hand it to them, you say, thanks so much for coming, because you've been talking to them that whole time, ideally.
Yes.
Don't go quiet when you're in sketching. Ask them about Comic-Con and then let them talk, because then they feel like they've had a nice moment. It's also fun to hear about Comic-Con, all the things that you're not getting able to experience. So you say, like, what's the most fun thing you've done at Comic-Con so far? Or, you know,
it's not hard to keep a conversation going while you're sketching. You don't have to do that much. All you have to do is ask leading questions and then respond to it, or do that old, you know, psychology trick where you take the last thing they say and you repeat it to them in the form of a question.
Right, they say,
oh, you know what? The neatest thing I saw was Deadpool over there with the Showtime Pizza animatronics. And then you go, Showtime Pizza animatronics. and then they take off from there. All you got to do is take those last few sentences or few words, make it into a sentence, and you can keep a conversation going without really doing a whole lot of mental checking in, and you can work on your focusing on your sketch. It's focusing. Yeah, you're sketching and talking.
I just did it to you.
Oh my God, that was, you're really good at this.
Oh my God, that was the greatest thing I've ever done. You didn't even notice that I was doing it while you were explaining it.
No.
Oh my God. To Brad's point, all you have to do is lilt your voice a little bit and edit in that Englishism of, you know, a question where you go a little high at the end. Oh my God, that's great. So anyway, wow, that was amazing. That was amazing. I'm going to cherish that one to my grave. Oh, I remember the time I got Brad while he was explaining the concept. sorry, I'm still enjoying that. Anyway, to get back to your earlier point, you go as long as the sketch is, and then you close the book, you hand it to them, and it's an immediate strong hand out shake, out extended. Thanks so much for coming by. God, it was really fun to talk to you. Because, by the way, all of that is genuine. It was really fun to talk to them. It was really fun to sketch for them. You're thankful that you bought the book, and have a great Comic-Con. None of this is a lie, by the way. I'm just telling you what I do.
Right.
If there's just a book purchased or someone coming by to say hi again, 30 seconds to a minute. Like, that's socially, there's nothing else that needs to be done there. And then really, if it goes past 5 minutes, I'm at that point doing the whole series of normal social cues of like, well, it's been really nice talking to you, or gosh, I don't want to hold you up, or I hope you enjoy the rest of the show. And then if it gets really bad, then you have to bring out the big guns, which is normally in human interaction, you would physically move your body away. You would say, hey, thanks so much. I've got to go over here now. You know, whatever you would do.
Yeah, exactly. My wife is calling me. I got to go over there and talk to her.
One of the reasons why Comic-Con gets awkward for people who are not particularly well socialized is that you can't give the greatest social cue of all, which is to walk away.
Right.
So because you are still standing there, they are still standing there. Do you know what I mean, Brad?
Yep. Yep.
Like
yep.
That's the big gun can never be brought out because you can't use it at a Comic-Con. So, and also let's come at this from the most basic point. They have been reading you for years, sometimes decades, and they're excited to talk to you. And
yes.
And God bless them, they should be. It's really fun. I get excited when I get to meet people that I read. But what's odd about it is sometimes people misinterpret their reading for friendship or for a relationship. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's where it gets awkward because I've been there too. Like if I could meet Douglas Adams right now, I'd be like, oh, I know everything about you, you know? And
yep.
That's... But he doesn't know anything about me, so it's not a two-way street. And so I would be like, anyway, thank you, Mr. Adams. This has been a lovely 1 minute talking to you. Have a good day. That kind of thing, you know?
Right.
You got to know to cut it off. And so sometimes people's genuine excitement gets ahead of their normal socialization skills, and they just keep talking, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, if it gets to that point, Brad, at the 5 minute point, I start breaking eye contact. Like I'm either rearranging something in my booth or you know, and that kind of thing. Still
or
answering.
Or go behind the screen or you know, like you and I used to take that end cap, and I see you still do it. You put the banner diagonally, and then you've got the V-shaped table out in front of you, and then you've got a triangle of space behind the banner that you can pile up books and your stock, and you can go back there and grab a sandwich if you want to without being stared at. And that's when I would usually go like behind the screen and say, oh, excuse me, I've got to go, make something up. I'm going to take a quick lunch break here. I'm starving, blah, blah, and go behind the screen and just sit for a little while. And
right.
They wander away. Dave, can we talk about one of the most brilliant methods that we had?
Is it the phone call?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Do you want to explain it or do you want me to explain it?
Well, it was your idea. You do the honors.
All right. So there was a particular Emerald City Comic Con where, for whatever reason, and with all of the best intentions that come with people's hearts, Brad and I both ended up with like two booth barnacles. And another thing, another big one to know is, are you going back every day at Comic-Con?
Yeah, yeah. Are you
that's
returning
another one. That's another
for an
little...
extended conversation? Yeah,
yeah, that's
stopping
another little...
by and saying, oh, hey, you know, I'm back for Saturday. I'm really excited. I get to see this person, that person. Hey, fantastic. Go out there. Have a good time. That's great. We love that. That's good. You come back and again, just a few seconds, little something there. But if you're lingering on, then you got to realize that artist or that creator you're talking to has other things that they need to get to. But go ahead.
Yeah, and it's not even, again, to reemphasize the basic human interaction there is that this is an artist that's paid thousands usually to come to a Comic-Con. And
yeah.
So you're taking... At that point, you're then diminishing their ability to. I mean, it's not what people. Everyone already knows this. That's listening, but anyway, Brad and I had an Emerald City Comic Con where we had both of us two very kind, enthusiastic readers that kept coming back and kept staying for a half an hour or 45 minutes, and this was over multiple days. So, like on day two or three, I said, Brad, I got an idea. And I go, I'm going to Google search an image of an old man sitting in a recliner chair. And he goes, what are you doing? And I changed Brad's contact photo so that when Brad called me, it would be this old man like holding up a coffee as a toast in an armchair with like a cat on his lap, right?
Yes.
And then I changed Brad's name on my contacts list to Grandpa Bubbins or whatever it was, right? It was just like Grandpa. And so if I was in minute 30 of a conversation that I could not escape from with a booth barnacle, just someone like, and then my cat Giggles knocked over all the cereal and you're like, what's going on here? Brad would very kindly and discreetly step back in the booth, turn around and call me and then just hold his phone at his side.
Yep.
And I would get, oh, I'd be like, oh, wait, I'm getting some kind of phone call. Oh God, it's my Grandpa Bubbins. Oh, look. And you'd kind of hold the photo out to be like, yep, that's my Grandpa Bubbins. And You would be like, you know what? It's been so lovely talking to you. This is a tricky moment for him. Can I take this phone call? Thank you for coming by. Oh, yeah, of course. Bye.
Yeah, he's 90 years old. God only knows how many phone calls I'm going to have with this guy.
Yeah, I've got to take this call. I'm sorry at Comic-Con. I've got to take this call. And then you'd step away and you'd be like, Grandpa Bubbins. Oh, it's lovely to hear you. And then you'd turn around in the booth and you take the call, right? And then Brad would keep selling and all that sort of stuff. But the amazing one that we had, Brad had a booth particle. And so I turn around and I call Brad. And Brad goes, oh, look, it's my grandma Susan. Oh, God bless her. She's calling right now. I've got to take this call. Do you mind? And the person goes, no, not at all. And so Brad takes the call. And he's doing like 2-3 minutes of vamping, like, yes, of course we'll come out for Christmas. Oh, we'd love to see you. Of course. He's doing all this. And he's going and going and going and going. And then he does the pretend phone hang up and turns back around. Booth Barnacle's still there waiting for Brad.
And now Barnacle wants to know how Grandma's doing.
Yeah, and that spurred a whole nother car. And then we had no backup. Like that, for Brad and I, that was our nuclear bomb. We had nothing past that.
We had done everything we could do at that point. You're just screwed.
Was like 15 years ago. The worst one I'd ever seen was the only bigger gun bigger than that. And Chris Straub used it. Was he said, you know what, I've got to go use the restroom. Anyway, lovely talking to you, have a great day. Chris legitimately goes, uses the restroom, takes a couple minutes, comes back, Booth Barnacle's still there.
Still it's
like
there.
Waiting for Chris to come back. And you're like, oh, God, this is so awkward. What do we do?
Now, we should have this talk. We should stop for a moment because every time we've done this conversation in the past or handled this topic, somebody comes up to us later on in the show or somebody writes an email or tweets us and says, oh my God, was I that person?
Right.
Let me tell you unequivocally, we're going to take a little, we've had a very funny chat here. Let me tell you, if you have any inkling that you might've been that person, then you're not that person.
That's the perfect way to summarize that.
Because I guarantee you that the people we're talking about are missing the cues to such an extent that they don't know that even if we told them that they're this person, they wouldn't really get that they're this person. It falls into that Dunning-Kruger kind of zone of they are just not picking up on this. So if you're listening to us right now and you think that you might have been that person, don't worry about it. You weren't.
Yeah, you hit it perfectly. It's very much Dunning-Kruger of like, they don't know what they don't know in terms of socialization. So they're not the ones that are going to be like, gosh, was that me? If you are even having the thought in your heart, Brad said it perfectly, that like, oh, was I a barnacle? I hope I wasn't. Then no, it wasn't you, because you have the empathy and the sympathy to go like, all right, no, it's been 2 minutes. Time for me to move on. And so that's what happened, I'm sure. You were not a barnacle. It is unfortunate to talk about this in a public way because it's sort of a fun shared moment for all cartoonists or anyone that has ever had to work a booth. But I don't want you to think, too, as a listener, that this is 99.9% of people are lovely, wonderful to talk to. The energy is great. The exchange is fun. It's literally fun for as my wife says, explaining to me why I like Comic-Con. She says, Dave, people come up to you, they give you a $20 bill, they tell you how wonderful you are, and then they walk away. Why wouldn't you love Comic-Con?
It's the closest I'm ever going to know what it's to be like a stripper.
Wow, that is not the way I was going to take that, but all right, thank you. I love.
And they have a much better way of handling barnacles. They just call over Tony, and Tony's, 6 foot four, 400 pounds, has no neck, and he handles you.
Yeah, Tony's arm is as big as you are. Anyway, I love Comic-Con because 99.9% of my human interactions are legitimately delightful. I come back from Comic-Con energized. I come back from Comic-Con inspired. I hold on to those moments, those wonderful moments and those conversations all year long because you remember that family that I was talking about that I revealed the commission to? Uh-huh. I'm going to hold on to their faces for weeks because that's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's like a hit of serotonin whenever I need it in terms of feeling great about my cartooning. So I love Comic-Con. I love the interaction. I genuinely love the conversation. So please don't ever be afraid to come talk to Brad or I or any other cartoonist you love to. It's this is a very specific, small subset of human beings who, not just at Comic-Con, probably in a chunk of their life, they just have trouble picking up on social cues. And as best we can, I want you to know, Brad and I, we've laid out the worst case scenarios for how we handle it. But also, the majority of the time, it's with kindness and love that we usher them through the conversation, and then we eventually figure out a way to duck out of it. But it's not like we're immediately breaking out the phone going, oh, Grandpa Biggins, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, that was a unique experience. But yeah. I can hear the excitement in your voice talking to you today. I mean, you are still on cloud nine. This is Tuesday. Comic-Con ended Sunday evening, and you're still kind of riding high from it. It's fun to listen to.
Well, cartoonists that say like, oh, why do you still do Comic-Con? Why do you still go? I get it.
You mean cartoonists like me?
Yeah. No, I'm not putting it on you. I'm just saying there's a lot of cartoonists like, boy, good luck to my friends at Comic-Con. Boy, what a shithole that is. Like, I get it, and I understand why they feel that way. But for me, I get a genuine charge out of San Diego Comic-Con. I love it. I love going to it. I love being there for 5 days. If I could transport myself there right now, I'm not joking, transport that myself right now to a Monday, Tuesday of Comic-Con, I would do it. I love it. I think it's so fun.
Yeah.
Do I get tired? Absolutely. Do I get more tired this year because Daddy's a little chunky this year? Absolutely. But I love being able to meet and talk to people. I love hearing kind words. I love hearing what storylines resonated with them or what they love about my comics in a way that you don't get from an email, you know, which ones they really liked, which ones they, you know, and sometimes you get personal stories of like, hey, I was in a dark place and your comics helped me this year. You know, after my mom died, my brother and I loved your comics. And that was one of the few things, you know, those kind of things. There's no amount of money that can make up for how wonderful that is for your heart. And that means a lot to me. I carry that for a long time.
Oh, how many times have you had somebody come over and say something like, well, I was stationed in Iraq, I was stationed in Afghanistan, and this being able to read this stuff made me feel like I was at home for maybe 5 minutes. And those are the people you just and I've had that happen a few times where or you know, like you said, I was depressed and this kind of gave me a little bit of solace for 5 minutes. Those are the people you just want to wrap up in your arms, and you know, those are the people. It's like that's finding out that you've made that kind of connection is transformative. It really is. That you really want to hold on to those people mentally for as long as you can. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, if you look at why we became cartoonists, those moments are the distillation of what we do, which is we're not building a house for someone to live in. We're not raising food for someone to eat. We're not fixing someone's body in a hospital. But what we can do is for just a few minutes a day, we can make their heart a little bit lighter and a little bit more joy-filled or a little bit entertained or distracted from an illness or a death or a divorce or a lost job. That's our job, is just 5 minutes of levity, you know, just for God's sakes, just let my heart have 5 minutes of levity. And so when you can give that to someone and they come up and tell you about it, it means the world to us. It's why we do what we do, you know? So I love it. I love Comic-Con in that regard. I think it's why I'm super energized. And then in the meantime, you also have someone cosplaying as a 12-foot tall Megatron walking by. Like, that's fun too, you know?
Yeah, there is a lot of neat stuff. It's like a circus of your favorite pop culture, and there's always something going on. That part I always loved.
One of my favorite things that I used to love doing with Brad Geiger when we would exhibit would be like, hey, Brad, look, fat Aquaman. Hey, Brad, look, fat Flash. Hey, Brad, look, fat Batman. There's a lot of those were always the fun ones for us.
And now those guys are looking at us and say, hey, take a look, couple of fat cartoonists. we've gone a little bit past our typical show, but I want to ask if there's one more like takeaway that you've got from the show, like one more moment of inspiration or a fun idea that to share, let's round this out with a nice positive talk about something that you got inspired by during the show.
Okay. Yes, I can do that. I can. Yes. All right. I can. I've got a lot, but I can summarize the big one.
Yeah.
And the big one I would give to you as a cartoonist is to think about your branding, visual branding at a Comic-Con.
Mm-hmm.
So the next time you're at a Comic-Con, walk around specifically to the expensive booths, the booths that cost between $30,000 and $150,000. Everything from an Image Comics booth to a Fox Studios booth, right? Like one of those ones that's just like, they just dropped a lot of cash. They just had $500,000 or whatever, and they just kind of drop a lot of cash. And I want you to look visually at what cues they use to tie their entire booth together with their product, with their people at their booth, with the signs at the booth, with the tables at their booth. Like, how do they visually tie it all together? Not because you're going to spend $150,000, but you're going to say to yourself, what can I spend at the $10 level, at the $150 level, at the $200 level that can get me a cohesive brand or look or style at a booth? And maybe all you can afford is stuff that you can hand draw. That's great. I saw some amazing booths at Comic-Con that were entirely black Sharpie on cardboard, but they did the entire booth that way. And it was kind of awesome. You know, like it was a look. Did it cost them anything more than $5? No, but it was a look, by God. And so it was a cohesive branding. And then, basically what I'm getting at is look at the strategies and approaches that the expensive booths use to brand themselves. And apply some of that to your booth. I think you will see some advantages to having a cohesive look at a booth that translates both from your product to your table to your tchotchkes that you're selling to your signage and to how you look. So that's my big takeaway that costs you nothing that you might want to incorporate into future shows.
And how can you do this? A couple things come to mind for me immediately. And that is, number one, obviously your logo is going to be part of that cohesive look, but also for all of your signage, for all of your handouts, your flyers, and stuff like this, think about the colors that you're using and the fonts you're using. You should try to limit yourself to one, maybe two fonts that you're using throughout. Those are your kind of house style fonts. And same thing for colors. You should have two, maybe three predominant colors that dominate your signage. And you should be mirroring that on your flyers. You should be mirroring that on any kind of handouts, at table dressing, drapery, stuff like that. If you can limit yourself and keep that color palette short and and unified and limited, you're going to find that that's going to have a big impact visually, and it's going to make everything at that booth feel like a unit, and it's going to help you stick out amidst the cacophony of visuals that are around you. If you can be unified and singular. Yeah.
In case it might be helpful, I recorded a quick video from Comic-Con about my booth and what I did this year. And so if you haven't gone to patreon.com/comiclab, it's probably buried a few posts down by now, but it was look for the dated posts that are around July. I don't know, Brad, what do you think? 19th?
Here's better yet. Go to the posts section of the Patreon page for Comic Lab and click on comic conventions. I tagged it as a comic convention post. So if you click on the comic convention tag, you'll have three or four returns to come up with, and it'll stick right out like a happy little thumb.
That's
I didn't
want
to say
phrase.
Sore thumb since I was talking about your video. I wanted it to be positive.
I just like it'll stick out like a happy little thumb. Hey, Doc, I got a problem here with my happy little thumb.
I got a happy thumb.
Oh boy. Anyway, so that might be helpful to you, but I think that always be thinking, hey, as you walk around a Comic-Con, what booths work for me? What caught my eye, and what directed me to like a featured product easily, or what showed me the prices easily, or what really communicated a message, whatever it was at Comic-Con, and how can I incorporate that into my work? And Brad is right. Give yourself a limited palette of colors to work from your table to your signs to your flyers to your whatever it is on your table. And then I, again, fonts are great. A nice, clearly to read font, clearly and easy to read font. That's simple. We'll keep them to one or two fonts. I think that's a great point. And in general, make it consistent from your logo to your characters to your table design. It's an extension of your artwork, basically. That big physical presence is an extension of your artwork. So
yeah,
design it in such a way that it all works together.
Yeah, that's key. Is just keeping it consistent. I like that a lot.
And then I think the only other thing that I would say, because I'm coming off a show where I'm very enthusiastic and things work right, is always be conscious of a show. Like, you've just heard me talk for an hour and a half about how excited I was about Comic-Con.
Mm-hmm.
But make sure that these are shows that you can make a profit on. Comic-Cons are no longer worth it as a marketing expense to go to if you're going to lose money or frankly, even break even. Or maybe it's worth it if you break even, I guess. But don't continue to do shows and don't try shows that you know you're not going to make money at. It's not worth it. There are easier and better ways to make money online, whether you're eBaying illustrations or doing a Patreon or doing a Kickstarter or doing mini projects over that weekend. So after an hour and a half of me being enthusiastic about Comic-Con, I, as the one who's drank the lemonade, want to tell you, as always with conventions, you want to make sure you can make money on it. Don't do it just to do it, and don't do it to lose money.
Yeah. In other words, what Dave's takeaway was, this is a good show for him. He's going to do it next year. His takeaway was not, it's time to do Wizard World Idaho. Or time to do another one of these smaller shows. And you don't see him flying out to the coast to do New York Comic Con anytime soon.
Exactly.
Because that's a whole different set of logistics that he's got to deal with. So I think your little warning is right. Make sure you classify this conversation in the right place in your brain.
Right. And make sure you also quantify what I didn't say, like Brad said. I didn't say I'm going to go do TCAF right now. I didn't say I'm going to go do New York Comic Con or Dragon Con or any of these other cons because, and this should be your takeaway, the reason I'm not is I don't make money at them, or I make such a small amount of money that's like not worth doing for four days, you know?
Right.
So the unspoken thing is that San Diego Comic Con was great for Dave Kellett. I guess I should do Comic Con. But also think of the 40 shows that I didn't mention that I don't do great at, you know?
Right.
So find the shows that you're good at. Great. Keep doing them. But don't do shows that you're not going to make money at.
Yep.
That's my big takeaway for this
my
week,
takeaway,
Brad Geiger.
My takeaway is I'm thrilled that you had a good show. I can hear the excitement still in your voice. And I know that we're probably going to circle around to this topic in the shows to come. And probably hear a little bit more here and there about your experiences at Comic-Con. And I'm thrilled to hear that you got so much out of that week. That's really kind of amazing for me to hear.
Oh, my God. I forgot to tell you the one favorite thing that happened to me. And then I'll let you close out the show.
I almost had you wound down, Kellett. I was ready to say you've been listening to Comic Lab, but go ahead.
It's like calming down a puppy when you almost get them calm and you're like rubbing their belly. And then all of a sudden someone opens a door down the hallway and the puppy's like, I'm up, I'm moving. So I got to tell you this one last thing and then I'll let us take you out with the outro.
Okay.
So, on Saturday, I've come to learn, based on the quality of their shoes and because I know some of them, that Hollywood scouts come down on Saturdays after they're done with work on Friday. They drive down to San Diego and they walk around just looking for properties that they could acquire, right?
Yeah.
So I had two conversations about this or on this topic with different companies on Saturday. One that I might follow up with. And the other one, though, is the funny one that I want to share with you, where this woman goes, oh, hey, I've been reading Drive online. I like it. And I go, oh, thank you. And she picks up the book. She goes, oh, this is the first act. And I said, yep. And she goes, wow, it's really nice. And she goes, has anyone acquired the rights? And I go, nope. And then she goes, wow, that's great. Wow. Like, she's really thinking about it at that point, you know, looking through the book.
She's vamping now while numbers go through her head.
Right. And then she gets to the end of the book where it says end of act one. Right. And she goes, so how many pages is the full story going to be? And I said, about 1,000. And Brad, you just see her kind of quietly put the book deck down on the on the table, and then just kind of walk, just kind of almost like float away. Bye, bye, gotta go now, bye.
It's like that scene in Blues Brothers where the nun just goes backwards back into her office, you know, without moving her legs. She just kind of floats backwards and kind of dissipates into the shadows.
Do you know, do you remember the camera shot that they that he figured out for Do the Right Thing, where they would be sitting on the dolly and then he would add in footsteps later on in sound effects?
Yeah.
That's what it was like. The acquisitions agent just kind of drifted away as though she was in Do the Right Thing and then added, you know, you add in sound effects of footsteps. So I could not have said something that disinterested her more than, yep, it's going to be about 1,000 pages. Bye, gotta go.
Well, you had another secret too for these Hollywood scouts to really get them interested. What you did, and tell me if I'm remembering this wrong, but they'd say, "Hey, are you interested in having this option?" You'd go, "No." Are you sure you're not interested? We could talk about this for a TV series, and you go, "Nah, I really don't want to give up the kind of rights and the creative control that I'd need to give up in order to do this. I'm really not interested." And all of a sudden, when you would say no, these guys would get really super interested in optioning your stuff.
That is true. That is true. That would happen.
The best way to get these people on the hook was to tell them you didn't want anything to do with them, and then they wanted you desperately.
Yeah, it's like high school all over again. I remember the conversation you talked about, because I have never, there was somebody from Nickelodeon or something that wanted to talk about Sheldon.
Yeah.
And I've never wanted to, I'm super willing to option Drive. For whatever reason, I never wanted to option Sheldon. I was just not interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that you would be like, "Holy shit, that works. Saying no works." Like, we were amazed. And so then I was doing it the rest of that show. Yeah. And like, nope, not interested.
And then anyway. Do you remember that time when the scout came up to me and he said, "Have you ever thought about optioning this?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, that's probably for the best," and walked away. And I'm like, how? What?
There's nothing funnier than when you're self-deprecating. I love it.
Oh, I wish it was self-deprecating. But anyway, that was one of my fondest memories. But what was the second agent?
Knowing what I know about Hollywood too, it's like whenever a cartoonist gets real excited about, like, "Oh yeah, they optioned my title for a movie," I'm always like, "Yeah, great, good for you." Because 99.9% of the time, nothing's going to happen with that option. You know, like,
yep.
And very often the unspoken truth is they only gave me $2,000 for this option. You know, like, it's not a lot of money. And they're going to hold it for 2 years and nothing's going to happen to it. So great. If you can get it, go ahead, option away, as long as you were well represented. But it's not a lot. Sometimes it's not a lot of money. And most of the time, nothing happens with it. So, but that being said, you and I both have friends that have optioned the same title 4 times and just takes whatever check and then options it again 2 years later.
Yep.
So that's fine.
So
anyway.
I am thrilled to hear you had a good time at the show. I am looking forward to hearing more as the months go on, and I have nothing yet to add except that, checking to see if anybody's coming in the door. Nope, my puppy is settled down. You've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been puppy wrangler Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And the amazing I'm getting lost for words, avuncular Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the fantastic Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this particular episode was edited by the fantastic Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions. You can find him at www.woodsong.media.
Boy, I don't want to be Matt today. This is, we gave him a handful.
Sure did.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice. Patreon.com/comiclab.